Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty on what is truly a landmark day in Michigan. With votes today by the State House, Michigan is now poised to become the nation's 24th so-called right-to-work state. The legislation now goes to Governor Rick Snyder. He says he will sign the bills into law. On today's show, we speak with Bob King, president of the United Auto Workers, and we'll take the temperature of Michiganders. Are we ready for right to work? But first, we begin inside the Capitol building. Michigan Public Radio's Rick Pluta is there. Rick, where are you right now, and what's the latest?
Right now, I'm on the ground floor of the state capitol. The House voted earlier today to send the two bills that will make up Michigan's new right-to-work law to Governor Rick Snyder. And as we all know, he said last week that he would sign them. The debating has been fierce here. It's been fierce inside the Capitol. It's been fierce inside the House. It's been fierce outside on the Capitol lawn, where we have seen some clashes between right-to-work supporters and union opponents. So now the next step is the people who oppose this are hoping that Governor Snyder will veto it, but that is probably a futile hope.
And Rick, how quickly is Governor Snyder expected to sign this? Is there a waiting period, or could he just go ahead and do it?
There is no waiting period. As soon as the bill is officially presented to him, he can sign it right then. We don't expect it today, but that doesn't mean that we won't see it today.
Now, you talked about this atmosphere inside the chamber, and we've been hearing about demonstrators pro and con outside. Talk to us a little more about what was going on both sides with the lawmakers.
You know, this is typically, you know, kind of a maudlin time of year. People deliver term-limited lawmakers delivering farewell speeches. This was very tense. People were angry. There was a sense of betrayal, not just with the fact that this issue was taken up, but by how it was done, that it was introduced and rolled out very quickly. There were no public hearings. There was no public comment. That there's a codicil that's tucked into it that makes it a spending bill, which means that it's immune to a voter referendum, like the one that was used to topple the state's emergency manager law, which doesn't mean, you know, that unions and Democrats aren't, you know, pondering their other options when it comes to opposing this.
Was there much speechifying as debate and deliberations went on?
Yes, as much as the result was ordained, there was a lot of time spent talking about it, and there were amendments proposed. They were either ignored by the Republican majority or they were quickly voted down.
Were there protesters inside the chamber, or were they kept in the rotunda?
No. Protesters never made their way inside the chamber. Some were in the rotunda. Some were in the lobby outside the House chamber. You could hear them chanting as you were standing inside the chamber while the debate was going on. From time to time, people who were sitting in the visitors gallery did applaud, and you know, were admonished not to. But this is a pretty emotional issue.
I would suspect, in all of your time covering Lansing and covering what's going on at the Capitol, this one must be one for the record books.
Absolutely. If I've ever seen anything, you know, quite this big and dramatic, I can't remember what it was.
Rick Pluta reporting live from the Capitol. Thanks for that, Rick.
No, my pleasure, Cindy.
Let's turn now to Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody. Steve, you've been outside the Capitol all day long. What's going on right now?
Well, the union members have moved from the Capitol grounds across the street to the George M. Romney building. That's where the governor's offices are. And so they're now focusing their attentions on the governor and their desire that he veto the right-to-work bills.
I've seen reports, and are these true, that sleeping bags have been brought and they're going to be parked there for a while?
Well, I'll tell you, it's a very large crowd. The state troopers went in riot gear to clear out a path to get, you know, to clear out the entrance to the Romney building. Two union members were arrested for resisting arrest, and they're now facing a 2-year felony if they end up being convicted of anything. At this point, the protesters are still blocking the building, though the entrance to the building has been cleared by the state police.
How is the atmosphere, or has the atmosphere, changed through the day, starting with early this morning and then as the votes were actually done? Could you see a change in the feeling?
Well, early on, there was a lot of optimism in the crowd. It was a very upbeat, positive crowd. They came here to accomplish something. As the realization that that wasn't going to happen and that the legislature was going to vote in favor of these bills, the mood soured a little bit. We saw some confrontations between union members and individuals who were here to support right to work. Then things kind of calmed down a little bit, but since the protest has shifted across the street to the Romney building, tensions are ticking back up again. The entire Capitol grounds at one point was completely covered, as well as streets to the east and further from the Capitol building. So there is a lot of activity going on all around this part of downtown Lansing.
Now, you mentioned confrontations between union demonstrators and folks who are pro-right to work. We heard a tent belonging to the Americans for Prosperity was torn down by the anti-right to work demonstrators. Any other destruction you saw?
Well, that's the only bit of destruction I've actually seen. I was there when they started tearing down that tent. Standing next to a couple of union men, and they said, well, this tent wasn't put up by union men, so it should be taken down by union men, at which point they started taking the poles out. The people on the inside, the Americans for Prosperity, were unaware that the tent was coming down until it fell down on top of them. Then the union people started walking on the tent while the pro-right-to-work people were still inside of it. So there were a lot of disheveled right-to-work supporters who came out from under the tent. When they did, they were confronted by very angry union members. A lot of words were exchanged, but that was about all.
And finally, Steve, the mood between the protesters and police, how has that been?
It has been growing, I would say, more tense as the day has gone along. Early on, the police were kind of standing back. They were in regular uniforms. But as the day has gone on, the state police have been showing more and more of their riot gear. And right now there is a line of state police troopers in full riot gear cordoning off protesters from the exterior of the Romney building. And the sheriff's horse patrol has been making its way through the crowd to kind of push it along as well. So there's been a lot of name-calling to the police, and the police have done what they could to keep the crowd under control. But obviously there's more tension now than there was earlier today.
Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody outside the state capitol. Thanks so much, Steve.
You're welcome.
And now let's turn to Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton. She's been digging into the economies of other right-to-work states. And Tracy, one of the things we've been hearing from Governor Snyder is he looked to Indiana, that first Midwest state to go right-to-work, and saw the benefits.
I believe this will bring jobs, and that's where I look to Indiana, where they literally can show companies that cited this as a factor in their decision to come that are bringing thousands of good jobs to that state.
So, Tracy, good jobs coming to Michigan. Is that an accurate statement?
Well, we're relying on what the Indiana Economic Development Corporation says. They have this long laundry list of companies that have set up as soon as they passed right to work. The problem is they only passed this law in March.
Mm-hmm.
And the guidelines for the law didn't even go into effect until August. So we're talking September, October, November, all this amazing economic development that's been going on. That's pretty fast work.
Yes.
So I spoke to Gordon Lafer. He's a professor of economics at the University of Oregon, and he looked at every single example Indiana's putting out there as proof that this right to work law is kind of a job magnet.
It would be amazing if it were true, but from what you can see, it is meaning from like the actual data put out by the State of Indiana Economic Development Commission, there's no basis for the kind of claims being made.
And in fact, the one company that the state of Indiana put out in a press release as saying right to work mm-hmm. actually was the deciding factor. They said, actually, we never said that. And they said it was not true.
Not true.
Mm-hmm. Most of these companies were already in Indiana, already planning to expand there.
All right. So where can we look to for whether right to work makes a state really more attractive to businesses?
Lafer says we need to look at the state of Oklahoma, which has had a right to work for legislation for a law for about 10 years. And back then when they were debating this, the legislators were saying we're going to see an 8 to 10-fold increase in interest from outside companies if we pass this. But in fact, in 10 years, the number of new companies setting up shop in Oklahoma actually fell by a third.
So the experience in Oklahoma is very, very clear that the kind of predictions made, which are the same predictions now being made about Michigan, which is you're going to be a jobs magnet, turned out to be utterly false. And this is not by me. This is by the state's own data.
So according to Professor Lafer, and he is with the University of Oregon,
yes.
So he is an impassionate observer, what does right to work really do?
Well, he says it does attract companies that are primarily interested in the bottom line. We want low labor costs, low wage, low skilled types of jobs. Those kinds of companies might be more interested in coming here, but he says even that's not necessarily a good thing. It's a job, but these companies aren't making very much. These people aren't mm-hmm. making very much money. They often don't have health insurance. They don't have the kind of buying power that we need to make our whole economy work better. So it's not necessarily just a gain.
Tracy, thanks for that report.
You're welcome.
That's Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton. Still to come, Bob King, president of the United Auto Workers, is on the ground in Lansing. We'll talk with him about what right to work will mean for the UAW. And we'll check in with a pollster. What do Michiganders really think about right to work? That'll be in 15 minutes. And be sure to let us know what you think about what's happening today in Lansing. We're on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And, of course, you can find us online, michiganradio.org. This is Stateside, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Stateside. The big story today, of course, being the legislature passing bills to make Michigan the 24th so-called right-to-work state. This morning on Michigan Radio, Governor Snyder said he believes this legislation will bring jobs to Michigan, and he believes it'll give workers the right to make choices about unions.
It actually should improve unions in many respects by making them more responsive to the workers. It's a case where workers can make that choice, and if unions present a good value equation, why wouldn't people want to join the union? And they do.
We wanted to get a response to that from one of Michigan's most visible union leaders, Bob King, president of the United Auto Workers Union. Bob, how do you respond to Governor Snyder when he says right to work will challenge unions to serve their members better?
You know, that's so ludicrous. You know, unions serve their members very well. Right to work is about trying to undermine unions' ability to serve their members. It's about dividing workers. I mean, it isn't good for companies. It's not good for workers. It's just an outrageous statement. He is following the agenda of the extreme right wing in Michigan and the United States. He's backed by the Koch brothers and the DeVosses. It's a huge mistake. It's bad for Michigan.
Bob, the UAW already, we know, operates plants in right-to-work states. Can you give us an idea? What's the general percentage of workers who choose to join the union, let's say in Texas, as compared?
You know, we have workplaces, large workplaces, 100%. We get some at 98%. We get some maybe a little less than that. But overwhelmingly, UAW members join because they're fair people and they know that they get the benefit of representation and they should pay for it. Just, you know, this is crazy. Would you allow, you know, people in a community to say, hey, I'll take the fire service, the police service, the road cleaning service, whatever else, but I'm not going to pay my taxes? That's crazy. Workers democratically vote to have a union in their workplace. They don't have to be members. Under the UAW Constitution, any worker can say, I don't want to be a member. Under the law of the U.S., any workers say, I don't want to be a member. So their statement about freedom of workers is just untrue. And they get away with telling things that are not factual. Now, members do and should have to pay their fair share of the cost of representation.
I want to talk politics with you for a little bit, Bob. For so long, labor and unions have really been the voice and the muscle of the Democratic Party in Michigan. How does this change things now?
You know, labor has been one part of an important component to helping Democrats and people who, not just Democrats, but independents, sometimes even Republicans, who support working families. We're proud to be part of a coalition with environmentalists, women's groups, civil rights groups, all these people in society who believe in a fair society for everyone, who believes that everyone should share in the prosperity of society, not just corporate CEOs, not just the wealthy. So we'll continue to be part of those political coalitions. And I think really that these folks have awakened a sleeping giant. You're going to see a lot more union members and a lot more working families, much more active politically.
So what next now? What are your plans for after
the
vote?
Well, there'll be some legal challenges to the law. I don't know that they'll prevail. But what most importantly is we're saying to our membership, we're saying to our political coalition partners, we've got to be more active. We've got to be more effective politically. In 2014, I think you'll see a major change in terms of politics in Michigan because the American people just spoke. The people of Michigan just elected President Obama by over 9%. They want a government that pulls people together, not pulls people apart.
How do you think you're going to accomplish this goal?
I think it's going to look like a lot more UAW members and teachers and teamsters and steel workers and nurses and on, a lot more working people realizing they have to get involved politically or they're going to keep losing at the economic table.
Bob King, as this has all been unfolding, and especially today, knowing that this is a day that's making history, really in Michigan and nationally, could you share with us what your thoughts and feelings are right now?
Well, you know, I'm energized by the amount of people that are out in Lansing today and that there are this many people that really care about it. I'm also angry that this governor who said he was going to pull people together instead is dancing the tune of the Koch brothers and Alec and the DeVosses. It's a real disappointment.
What would you believe or feel that your relationship's going to be like going forward with Governor Rick Snyder?
To his credit, the governor has worked with us on some issues. But again, this was such a huge disappointment, and this was so contrary in such a flip of position. I don't know what it means for the future. How do you trust somebody who says he doesn't want to do this for 2.5 years and then flips and does it?
Bob King, UAW, thank you for talking with us today at Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so we just heard UAW President Bob King point a finger of blame at Alec, the Koch brothers, and Michigan's DeVos family, claiming they're pushing right to work. Michigan Radio investigative reporter Lester Graham has reported on both Alec and the Koch brothers, and we turn to him now to learn a little more about what's going on here. Lester, let's start with Alec. Just who or what is the American Legislative Exchange Council?
Well, basically, it's supposed to be a group of legislators from different state capitals who get together and they pay dues to get into this group. But actually, that's not where their money comes from. Their money comes from Exxon and the Koch charitable foundations. And basically, what they do is they put together model legislation to use throughout the United States that will benefit major corporations or conservative principles or libertarian principles. So these groups like Exxon, like the Koch industry folks, like Big Pharma will get together and say, this is the boilerplate language. Now, you could tweak it a little bit for your unique circumstances in your state, but this is what we want you to pass. And that's what they work to do. Then with the Americans for Prosperity, like the Americans for Prosperity chapter in Michigan, they work to make sure that this gets pushed through. And they, you know, dine and wine these legislators, and if that doesn't work, if the sweetness doesn't work, they threaten them with more conservative candidates in the primaries.
Meaning we can take you out next election.
Right, exactly.
Now, do we have any idea how many Michigan legislators are members of ALEC?
I do not know how many members are members of ALEC. I do know that Senator Michael Green is the chair for Michigan. I do know that even those who are resistant to ALEC basically have to take them seriously because they will go after them. We saw that happen with Fred Upton, the congressman from the southwest part of the state. Fred Upton was challenged by Jack Hogendyke, who happens to be closely related to Scott Hagerstrom, who's with Americans for Prosperity. Scott Hagerstrom used to be his aide. So you see these groups and these people working together and using a lot of money from the Koch brothers to make sure that they get what they want. So it's a nice little funding package with big industry, big corporate America funding ALEC, and then Americans for Prosperity getting funding from some of those same sources and different sources. They work together to put the pressure on these legislators to make sure that they get the legislation they want in a state like Michigan.
And in a sense, with the manufactured legislation, you have unelected people really, if it gets passed, setting policy.
Well, keep in mind, these people are still our elected representatives. Who they're influenced by is part of the system. We elect them. They pass these laws on behalf of the big corporate America. Hopefully, we get thought of in the process.
Lester, thanks very much.
Certainly.
Michigan Radio's Lester Graham is with Michigan Watch. As momentum built in the past couple of weeks towards today's historic vote, Republicans and supporters of right to work claim that public opinion in Michigan is on their side. How true is that claim? We turn now to pollster Bernie Porn of Epic MRA. They've been surveying voter attitudes in our state about right to work for years. Bernie joins us now from Lansing. Welcome to Stateside, Bernie.
Glad to be with you.
Well, Epic MRA certainly has been tracking voter attitudes since about June 2007. So take us back 5.5 years ago.
Well, we were asking the same questions then that we are now, with some very minor alterations in the wording of the questions. But back then, we asked what people thought about right to work, and you had 62% at that time saying that they supported the concept of right to work. And then when we asked about whether Michigan should be made into a right to work state, 59% said that they agreed with that idea. And there's been a sea change of opinion on that issue when you look at how voters view it now.
Yes. So tell us how support changed by the time you've last asked that question. Start with the in general, what do you think of right to work?
The 54% majority said that they support the concept of right to work. Mm-hmm. However, when we asked them about making Michigan a right to work state, all of a sudden that shifted dramatically, and it was dead even. 47% said they favor making Michigan a right to work state. 46% said that they opposed the idea. But what is more important is that when you look at the first question to the second, the intensity, there were more voters saying that they were strongly in favor of the concept of right to work, but when you ask about Michigan, the numbers reversed, and there's more that are strongly against making Michigan a right-to-work state.
Bernie, what do you think is behind that? Is that kind of a NIMBY, not in my backyard?
I think so, and it has always had a gap between the concept of right to work and the idea of putting it in place in Michigan. I think that probably people understand the union history in Michigan, so there are some people who pause about the idea of making Michigan a right to work state, even Republicans, by the way.
Interesting. And then you gave them very detailed statements in support of right to work and against. And what happened then?
Well, once they hear the arguments for and against, and essentially those arguments are what people are saying right now on both sides, and opposition jumps to a majority. 51% say that they are opposed to making Michigan a right-to-work state, and much lower percentage favor it. And what is important is, the intensity increases to 41% saying that they are strongly opposed.
Now, give us an idea of who these respondents were.
A random sample of active and likely voters in the state of Michigan, just like we do every month.
Yeah. Now, what did you learn when you asked them about the likelihood of voting for state legislators and Governor Snyder if right to work passes?
Well, we asked them whether their legislator voted for right to work, they'd be more or less likely to support that legislator in the next election. 39% said that they would be less likely to support the legislator, 27% more likely, 28% said it wouldn't really make a difference. When we asked about Governor Snyder and his position after saying that he had opposed taking up right to work and feels that it would be divisive if he changed his mind and decides to sign it, whether they'd be more or less likely to support him. And 40% said that they would be less likely to vote for him, 24% more likely, 31% said it wouldn't make a difference. Mm-hmm. So those numbers clearly show that although it appears as though Governor Snyder and the Republican-controlled legislature are going to win the battle today, Either today or soon, Governor Snyder will sign a right-to-work law for Michigan. They may well lose the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Governor Snyder may well have presented Democrats with a solution to turning people out in a gubernatorial election year by taking this action.
Interesting snapshot into the attitudes of Michigan voters toward right to work from Epic MRA. And we've been talking with pollster Bernie Porn. Thanks so much for talking with us today, Bernie.
Glad to be with you. Take care.
From Lansing, let's head north, way, way north, where wolves and moose are at the heart of the world's longest-running study of a predator and its prey. The drama unfolds on Isle Royal National Park in Lake Superior. It's a big island, almost entirely wilderness. Researchers from Michigan Tech say they can't cover all that ground alone. So they enlist some volunteers, folks who don't mind getting a stick in the eye for the sake of science. The Environment Report's Rebecca Williams has more.
Moose Watch is a backcountry expedition where you pay to help out with the wolf moose study. But be warned, it's no easy little walk in the woods.
We're just going to trash through the understory here for probably third to half of a mile and see if we can find some dead moose.
That's Jeff Holden. He's a Moose Watch group leader in charge of five volunteers. We're going to push our way into the thick forest. I put an arm up to keep the branches from whacking me in the face. Jeff Holden's got GPS to guide us, but it's easy to lose sight of each other as the forest swallows us up.
Sue, Jeff, Pete!
This is typical, all the yelling around.
Everyone's eyes are down, looking for a flash of white in the moss.
Bone. Who's got the bone?
I do.
So, Dave Beck just found a bone, and generally what happens is whoever finds a bone yells, bone!
Yep.
We all converge on it, and then we drop packs. Sue's got the flag. She puts orange flags up in trees so we know where the center of the search is.
The team fans out and spends a few minutes looking for more bones, but no luck. Jeff Holden says when wolves kill an adult moose, they'll rip it apart and drag the parts in different directions.
The farthest I found, like a confirmed moose pulled apart, was a quarter mile.
These bones hold all kinds of secrets, clues to how a moose lived and died. The volunteers collect skulls and leg bones from the moose skeletons and carry them all week in their backpacks. We push on, finding a few shed antlers, but no moose skeletons. It's muggy, and right around the time I'm regretting wearing non-breathable rain pants...
That's pretty much directly overhead.
Everybody puts on rain jackets, and we hurry back to the camp, getting totally soaked.
We are making hot chocolate. Sugar and heat. It's a good thing in the rain after hiking.
Yes.
This is Pete Prodzik's second Moose Watch trip.
The thought of walking where somebody hasn't walked in a long time or maybe never is really seems to be magical and special. And also there's a little bit of the aspect of can I hike off trail with a 45-pound pack, and the challenge of it is part of the attraction too.
That complete break from everyday life is a big draw for these volunteers. But they also say they like helping with the wolf moose study. Ann Schumacher and her daughter Kelsey came out here from upstate New York.
You never know. I mean, a bone we pick up might make a big, huge difference 10 years from now or help them find something 10 years from now that may really change things and help. So it's a small way to be part of something really big.
The three crews on this trip found 18 dead moose. Biologist Rolf Peterson says people from all over the world have joined Moose Watch. Military veterans, engineers, railroad workers, and even professional models.
We rely completely on those volunteers to come every year, and they cover hundreds and hundreds of miles and weeks of effort that we could never do any other way.
And Eric will get bored if we keep doing the same.
After a week in the woods, the Moose Watch volunteers gather at Rolf and Candy Peterson's cabin. They eat a hot meal and show off their scars. Then the Petersons and the group leaders stand up and serenade us.
Bone ain't it great to do moose watch. Bone ain't it great to do moose watch. Searching for moose bones all day long. Bone ain't it great to do moose watch.
For Stateside, I'm Rebecca Williams.
You can find out more about Rebecca's trip and see photos of Isle Royale, just head online and go to michiganradio.org. Still to come, moms and dads, we have all seen it. Moody teenagers saying they hate school, they hate their lives. But when does a parent actually need to be worried? Worried there's something more than just the usual angsty feelings going on inside their teen? We'll find out more coming up next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, ask just about anyone who has a teenager in the family. Your standard-issue teenager can be a moody, challenging presence in the family, and that is not new. But what does seem to be new and incredibly alarming to parents are reports of teens committing suicide. One statistic, 65 teens in the United States die every day from suicide. One example of a community coping with teen suicides is Oakland County's Lake Orion, where there have been 10 suicides in the past 4 years among current or former Lake Orion students. So how is a parent or a concerned friend or relative supposed to tell the difference between normal, surly teen behavior and behavior that could indicate that that teen is harboring thoughts of suicide? For this discussion, we turn to two people who are part of the team at the University of Michigan Depression Center. Dr. Richard Dopp is a psychiatrist whose special areas of expertise include depression in teens. And the outreach coordinator for the U of M Depression Center, someone who battled depression even as he was a football star for Utah State and a starting quarterback for the Detroit Lions, and someone who lost his own son to suicide, Eric Hipple. It's so good to have you both with us in the studio. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us. Here. Appreciate
Thank you.
It.
Dr. Dopp, I want to start with you. Is the actual teen suicide incidence increasing, or is it just that the news coverage and the headlines are so heart-wrenching and tragic it seems that way?
Well, certainly there is a lot of news that goes out when there's the loss of a teen. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, what we try to do at times is to prepare communities of how people are going to respond to that. And at times, you don't want to romanticize that process too much because you really want to get the message out that there are alternatives. Mm-hmm. And so what we see over time is that certain populations will have an increase in suicide. But actually, I think what you're actually seeing is more people are talking about it.
Which is a good thing, right, Eric?
Well, it is a good thing. Contrary to myth, if you talk about it, then you're going to make it happen. But the actual numbers from the 1950s to where we are today, there's about a 300% increase in adolescent suicide. And but the numbers have actually come down by rate anyway. They're not the highest rate per group, which has come down the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. But you're so like what Rich said, you're hearing a lot of the talk and everything else that's going on about it. So it's certainly become an issue. A lot of that has to do with social media, has to do with, there's not just three channels anymore. There's
right.
a whole bunch of ways to get news out and everything else that goes along with it and Twitter and all that stuff. So you hear a lot more about it. When times are in trouble, then, obviously it gets, focused in on.
Like we've seen in Lake Orion.
Correct.
Certainly that. And the idea of the romanticizing, I would suspect having Facebook and having Twitter and having social media where it's so easy for kids to share does not help that problem, does it?
Well, I like to think the internet is a powerful force that can be used for good, mm-hmm. but kind of like the force in Star Wars can also be used in a negative way.
Yes.
And it's important to try to use it as a support and a positive way to cope at times. But also, it's important to be involved in your child's interaction mm-hmm. with the world in that way so that you know that they are continuing to process this information in a way that they're able to understand and make sure that if they are having trouble, they know there's options for treatment. And that's really a message that needs to get out in every suicide. There's a message that this is a medical illness that needs to be treated.
Eric, fans in Michigan watched you as a Lions quarterback in the 80s, and I would dare say most would have never guessed that you battled depression as a teenager in college. When you were going through that, did you recognize that as I'm depressed? What was going on?
Not at all. In fact, I blamed it on weather. It's snowy. It's this. I don't, it's gloomy. I don't feel like getting up and going out today. And so I just figured it was kind of just a moody thing, you know, even though it was pretty severe at times and actually affected my grades at school during my sophomore year. But yeah, I just cast it off as just, you know, hey, that's just something. Because, you know, I didn't have a name for it. Mm. You know, we didn't discuss this. We didn't have – I didn't know what the symptoms were. In fact, not even up until through Jeff's deal did I really have a name for it and really quite understand it. Not until after Jeff died did I finally get some understanding about what exactly it is and what we call it and how it affects and what the symptoms are.
And now, did you experience it during your NFL career, or were you just so busy?
I can remember this is funny. I remember sitting in the Ken Fantetti, a linebacker, and we're sitting in my backyard, and it's actually during the off season, and we're talking, and I just looked at him and I said, "Are you happy?" I go, "I'm not happy." And he goes, "Yeah, sometimes, yeah." It's just very poignant part of my mind of just sitting, why aren't we happy? I mean, you know, we're at the peak of our career. You know, we're in the off season. We can do anything we want to. We don't have to go to work today. You know, and yet it was just that. And but I didn't think of it, you know, really as anything that's that could be serious, or certainly didn't look at it as an illness. It was just a sense of, you know, my well-being wasn't very good. That's all.
And after your NFL career ended, it really hit hard.
It hit hard about – actually not right after the career was over with. I mean, there, you go through that shock and kind of stun and, you know, through the event of that transitioning goes through a little bit. You know, self-identity and stuff goes through it. But I actually, you know, thrived for about 7 years. Well, I'll take that back. I thrived for about 5 years.
Oh, okay.
And then I dragged along for a couple of years, and then the wheels kind of came off.
And then not really knowing. Now, where did the death of your son Jeff fit into this continuum?
He actually came, in the year 2000. So, you know, I had gone through the transition. I'd been successful business-wise. And then, as I said, you know, went through another episode. And then I got back on my feet again and started to thrive again, you know. So the year 2000, when he died, he actually was experiencing every classical symptom. And, you know, Rich can probably go through those symptoms with you. But every classical symptom he had, and you know, I knew something was wrong.
You know.
Yeah, because I've been there before, but it was like, well, you know, I just didn't realize that was it was unfathomable that he would ever take his life, and so I couldn't even imagine it. You know, he'll drag along, we'll get through this thing and everything else, and it didn't happen.
I do want to have Rich address what some of the symptoms would be and sync that up with what you went through. But my first thought is, as the parent of a teen, and I've got one that's in his 20s now, but as a parent, there is such a natural thing when they come and say something that is upsetting. You want to say, oh, come on, you're okay. You're okay. You want them to be okay. And I think a lot of us will do that, Rich. Not the right thing to do, is it?
Well, it can really depend upon the teen. You know, the one thing I take from both of those stories and Eric's story of dealing with depression himself and also looking back, having a child who was dealing with depression and still not aware of it, that I think it's a real challenge for the teens to think of this as depression. And it's also hard for parents to think about it that way. You know, I may get to how you might approach your child in those tough times in a second. But in terms of those signs and symptoms, obviously we talk about sadness and irritability is another thing. It's not always, woe is me, I'm sad and melancholic. Oftentimes it's, I'm irritable, angry, under the surface, sensitive to any comment.
That's teenagers. That's the problem.
And that's the challenge, is how do you differentiate that from a normal teen?
Exactly. That's exactly what we wonder.
You know, I was at a school speaking yesterday, and a woman came up to me afterwards, actually one of the teachers, came to ask me and says, you know, I got to ask you a question, and started down the line. You know, I'm really worried about my son, and started talking about, because there was another family they knew that had lost a son, you know, just recently, and so he was asking questions. But I said, so look at the other things. I mean, so he might be a little sad, he might be experiencing these things, but look at the other factor. You know, he was still connected, he had great friends, his grades weren't affected, and so those other things were intact and in place, and so you have to put it in context.
When we think of what types of mood shift warrants treatment, a lot of times we're looking at function. How is a youth functioning in what their expectations are? And usually my first line is, the job of the child is to go to school. So how is school going? And sometimes a lack of motivation, or what my patients tell me, a lack of ability to generate enough energy to care. Sometimes that's the first thing we see in depression, a drop in grades, but also withdrawal from your peer group. I think parents a lot of times worry about changes in peer group, substance use, changes in sleep, difficulty concentrating, and really that level of frustration and argument in the household sometimes.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside, and I'm Cynthia Canty, and we're talking about dealing with teenagers and depression and how a parent can tell whether a upset, surly teenager is one who might become a teenager considering or committing suicide. And we are talking with two representatives of the University of Michigan Depression Center. We have Dr. Richard Dopp, who's a psychiatrist, and someone known to Detroit Lions fans, our quarterback for the Lions all through the 80s, Eric Hipple. Eric, who actually suffered from depression through his life and lost his teenage son, Jeff, to depression and suicide in 2000. Talk about what you saw with your son, Jeff, that perhaps we could learn from. We parents could learn. You said you knew things were not right with Jeff.
Well, you know, his first symptoms probably started the year before, in around springtime, and then he made it through the summertime. Things were all great. Entered into a new school as a freshman. Things were great, doing wonderful. Captain of his freshman basketball team, and then approaching spring sometime around there, all of a sudden it started hitting him again. Where all of a sudden his grades started dropping. He changed his set of friends, but it was really funny. He didn't change to a rowdy group or something. He just changed his pretty popular group, and he changed all of a sudden to those that were more in need. In other words, so he started hanging out with somebody that he could help. And then withdrawal from his normal set of friends, and then kind of total withdrawal, where he started coming back to his room. He didn't want to talk to anybody. He'd just go into his room. I could hear him up at nighttime walking around, rearranging his room at 3 o'clock in the morning, and then be really, really tired in the morning and not want to get up and not go to school. And so, stomach aches, had stomach aches. And just his demeanor when he'd walk up the driveway, after he was just his whole body slump was there, just like dragging. It felt like he was dragging an anchor, And so you could see it in his body as well. And that was probably, the culmination. The morning that I left I had to go on a business trip. The morning I left, I woke him up to tell him goodbye, and he had tears in his eyes. And so it looks like he had But it looked like he hadn't slept, throughout the nighttime. And you could tell, something was really going on. And that was, that's the last time I saw him.
And it would have been so easy for you to have taken this tragedy and this loss because you got a call that he had committed suicide from that when you were on that trip.
Yeah. I got the call the next day.
It would have been so easy to say, I'm hiding away and just trying to deal with this myself, but you turn this, Eric Hipple, into something where you want to reach out and help other families, and your work at the Depression Center speaks to that you share what is truly a tremendously sad story so that others can learn.
Yeah, it's really important, and nothing, if nothing else, just the awareness of that there is an illness out there to be aware of. What are the symptoms that, that Dr. Dopp, that Rich is talking about and going through, because they're really important to know, because if you're experiencing those things, there's things that we can do to help. But if you don't know what it is, and in fact, I can my talks, what we don't know can hurt us,
Yes.
And so let's be aware of what we do know. And so let's take advantage of the education. Let's push this message out there. Let's say it's okay to get help, get rid of the stigma about mental illness. Let's talk about mental health, that it's good to be healthy. And so what do we do to be healthy? What are the signs and symptoms so we know when things do go wrong, we can, that we know what it looks like not to be healthy. And so then we can, start getting help.
In terms of reducing stigma, I try to make comparisons between depression, anxiety, ADHD, to other medical illnesses like asthma or diabetes, where of course you would take your child to seek help.
Certainly.
Although it's a tough choice as a parent and a little humbling to walk in and say, hey, I need help. My child needs help.
Sure.
It's also tough for providers like myself to meet with patients who didn't choose to come.
Okay.
To see me.
Nothing like a cranky 15-year-old with his arms crossed looking at you like, I dare you.
I will sometimes start an interview with, so where would you rather be? And I think that's important to meet them where they're at and that they are resistant to this process.
If you suspect your teen is depressed, someone came up to you, Eric, and shared concerns. So if there's some deep down pinging going off in your parental radar that there's something to worry about, how do I as a parent bring it up? Do you just put it out there? Because there is that worry, if I speak it, maybe she or he hadn't thought about it, and oh my God, I've planted a seed. What are the do's and don'ts of what to say?
Well, I think you use the phrase concern, and that's what's important to convey, is I'm concerned. I think sometimes it's in the midst of argument or severe disappointment or I didn't do something I was supposed to. And that's the time when this idea of meeting with a mental health professional gets pitched. And so it's associated with a consequence in some ways. And so one way is to really think as the parent, okay, I'm worried my child has a medical illness. I am concerned about you for these reasons. You can tell me why I shouldn't be concerned, but I still might say, hey, I need to bring someone else in. We need to meet with a mental health professional to help sort this out.
And, you know, and to a certain degree, I think parents sometimes have a tendency, I've been there myself, whereas when a kid's down or something's going through, well, come on, what do you got to be sad about? You know, come on, look it around. And that's just the opposite of what you should do, because all of a sudden it builds a wall because they can't help what they're feeling. They're feeling it. And so the best thing is to, reaffirm that and just say, I understand, but let's talk about that. Let's open a dialogue. And sometimes I think it's okay to say, let's actually use a definition of what mental health is. You know, a sense of well-being, able to handle stresses, you know, being able to be productive, you know, and you have a sense of community with your friendships and stuff around you. And if that's not what's going on, then let's talk. What is going on? And so you can open it by, this is what it looks like to be when things are okay. And if that's not what's happening, then let's discuss what is happening. And so that way you open the door in a positive way, not like negative consequences.
Well, I think there's another issue in that sometimes there's other people in the family who are dealing with depression. Sometimes the parents are dealing with depression and sometimes are resistant to seek treatment themselves. But there are maybe some who have sought treatment and are able to share that with their child. There is some genetic contribution to this, as well as that environmental struggle. And so both things are at play. And so to be able to share with your child that you've struggled like this before and you'd like to help them. In proactive families, it's being able to model, I have some challenges and I seek help. I am willing to ask for help. And what a great example for your child.
So don't be afraid to show human frailties to your child. I started with you, Dr. Richard Duff. I'd like to end with you, Eric Hippel. What's the most satisfying part of the work you've done with the Depression Center?
There's a couple things. One is having a kid from a presentation, a student, or, you know, come up to me afterwards and say, thanks, you know, that helped. Or I'm experiencing some of these things. Thanks for pointing it out. Or at times this happens, and I think this is probably the most satisfying. Thank you for what you're doing. I now understand my dad. I now understand my mom. You know, and so it kind of lightens that. And so some of the kids I've worked with have actually gone and brought the information to their parents and opened up a dialogue. And so I think that's that's success. I like that.
Dr. Richard Dopp and Eric Hippel, thank you so much for speaking with us and sharing your stories today with us and insights.
Thank you.
And you can contact Eric Hippel or Dr. Richard Dopp and the U of M Depression Center team at depressioncenter.org. And we put that and other links on our Stateside page at michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. We are engineered today by Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow at 3:00.